1935, the Lions win the NFL championship. The Detroit Tigers take the World Series. The Red Wings bring home Lord Stanley's Cup. Joe Louis begins his rise to world domination. This transforms the Motor City into Detroit, City of Champions.
Ah, there we go. Stick it into the ground, ringing the bell. That's what we do here, Detroit, City of Champions, the podcast. I'm Jamie Flanagan.
Charles Avison.
Charles, good to see you, man.
Good to see you, too. It's been a couple weeks,
man. Yeah? Yeah, it's...
You got the City of Champions shirt on?
We got the City of Champions swag happening when Chris
cool
tunes
shirt.
In.
Yeah, Chris is
here. These turned out nice on the shirt.
Yeah, it looks really good.
So cityofchampions.com is where you can get all the connections about finding the books,
yeah,
the trilogy of books that Charles wrote, and then there's links to wearingfunny.com, and that's where you can get the podcast swag and lots of other Detroit-themed t-shirts and funny t-shirts. I'm very, very funny. Charles,
are you?
I am. I'm extraordinarily
who tells you that?
Handsome and funny.
It's who tells you those
I got the and yeah. I don't know. My mom.
Yeah, you sure.
My mom
yeah,
thinks that.
Yeah, Jamie, you sure
I'm great.
Are. You sure are, man. Oh, yeah, I agree.
But yeah, no, we got to thank Chris for helping design the shirts and getting them uploaded into Wearing Funny. And I bought a couple test ones. So
yeah, that was great. Now so I got to get myself some of that.
Right? You know?
I got to wear some City of Champions gear a little more often. I need to represent a little more.
I hope you're extra large.
You got? Oh, cool, man. Thanks. Yeah, yeah. Now I can't. Now I can look
now
like
you can.
Jamie.
We'll match.
Appreciate
but you just,
you, Jamie.
I wanted to give it to you. It's, we're sitting here matching. Then, you know, I don't know.
That's kind of cool. What's wrong with that?
It's a little something.
I can rock it. I'll rock it next show. I'll rock it next show. I haven't worn it.
There you go.
Sweet, man. I appreciate it. That's a great gift.
Because the next show, we'll still be talking about Walter Hagen because the guy is just...
Yeah, we've got...
We're not even anywhere close to 1935 yet,
no.
And we're still working through Walter's story because he's just amazing.
Yeah, we'll probably warp speed. Once we get to like... We're in 1922. We're going to be doing 1922.
Yeah.
Once we get to like 1929, we'll kind of warp speed to 35 a little bit. Like... we're just talking about this like evolution of him and like how like these constant like these just it sets the stage. So by the time that the 1935 comes, it's because it's one thing to say Walter Hagen was the captain of the first Ryder Cup champion, Ryder Cup.
Oh, was it the first championship
for
the Ryder Cup?
Yeah, I believe it was the first on U.S. soil. I think it was. It was one thing. But he was a captain.
35.
But in the case, he was the 1935 World Cup Ryder Cup captain, right? But when you say that, there's a lot of people that like myself. I didn't really know much about golf and all this either. I just didn't know much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But when we get to the point where we show like the teams that were like that faced off against each other for the Ryder Cup, you're gonna be like, oh my god, that's so awesome. You're gonna recognize what a big deal it was that you have Walter Hagen from that Hagen is calling himself a Detroiter, and that the people that he's there at this Ryder Cup with, like he's gonna be like the most one of if not the most revered golfer of his era at that moment, and you're gonna be like, this was a huge deal that Detroit could claim Walter Hagen as one of its pantheon of stars.
And better still, he claimed Detroit.
He claimed Detroit, yeah. He's buried in Southfield.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
so
he's
Traverse City.
He died in Traverse City. He's buried at this Holy Sepulchre Cemetery.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought he was planted up in Traverse.
No, he wrote his autobiography up in Cadillac.
Ah. Because
he had a house up there. And he's, yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. So, yeah. So,
well, I missed.
He died in Traverse City.
Okay. Fair play. Wow. All right. So
what I'm saying, in either case, he's a Michigan guy.
Yeah.
He's a Michigan guy. And if you want to double check and fact check me on that, go
no,
ahead.
No, seriously, if it comes up differently.
But I mean, he's buried in Michigan. He lived in Michigan. He called the DIA the building he was more familiar with than any building in the entire world. He's the first club professional in Oakland Hills.
The DAC, yeah.
I'm sorry, DAC. Yeah,
yeah. I got a wedding coming up at the DAC.
Yeah.
I think I said that. I'm DJing a wedding.
But
coming
of course,
up there.
Hagen is like all over the globe. He's a jet setter totally.
Yeah.
But I didn't hear him mention it. Like he wasn't talking about Chicago the way he talks about Detroit.
No.
You know, he wasn't talking about Ohio the way he's talking about Detroit, even though he spent a lot of time in all those cities. But he talks about Detroit as his home. And that's what I'm saying, being able to claim one of the greatest golfers of all time is a big deal. But before you realize how much of a big deal it is, we have to understand what a legend he was. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the build up to, you know, his 35 role, you know. So that's basically our, you know, clue to, for, you know, to talk about where we're at, you know, right now.
All right. So where are we picking up?
So, you know, where we left off was in the last week was that it was the was how he had just lost. He played in his first British Open and his first British Open in 1920. And what was it? He played his first British Open and he got destroyed.
His backside handed to him. Yeah.
Yeah. He finished
second to last.
53rd.
53rd out of 54. Yeah. Yeah.
So he finished 53rd.
It was kind of dismal.
Yeah. It's a terrible finish. And then he goes to the French Open and he wins the French Open, which is like a consolation prize.
Yeah,
but
in
his own words, he said it turned out amazingly because that was the first like national open golf championship that he won. Mm-hmm. Like, and then it started off a string of 11 straight.
Wow.
You know, or actually, I think it was the second one that he won in a row. And that's that was his second national open championship in a row. And so he had 9 more years of winning a national open in some capacity.
Dang.
So 11 years in a row of winning some country's national open. And so that's, you know, he's like, I didn't know it at the time, but it was like pretty cool because it like helped me establish this huge streak. You know, that was my second in a row. So when he comes back from this, I just kind of have this in my notes, which I thought was kind of interesting. Yeah. So upon his arrival to the U.S. following that, those situations, the British Open and the French Open, he changes his signature. So up until this point, his signature had been W.C. Hagen.
Uh-huh.
After this, it's going to be Walter Hagen.
Okay.
And he says in his book that he played so bad in England and that people were in Britain that people were calling it Water Closet Hagen.
Oh my God!
So they were making fun of him with the W.C. Hagen, and he said he said it built up kind of a stink in his home.
He was drinking like W.C. Fields.
Yeah, they were making fun of him because they were saying. So I just thought it was interesting because if anybody ever sees an autograph that says W.C. Hagen,
that's old.
Before he even you can kind of date it because he says in his own book. You know, from, you know, 19, you know, it was when he got back following it. That's when he said, as soon as I got back, I stopped writing W.C. Hagen and just sort of going to Walter. So if you see a W.C. Hagen, there's probably a collector's premium on that because that's like, you know, that's early Hagen. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I just thought that was kind of cool. It was worth mentioning.
The early Hague.
Yeah. So upon his return, you know, shortly thereafter. You know, last week we were talking about the American invasion, how there's this, you know, Americans headed to the Open in Britain to win that. And then it was the Scot that won that one. Duncan won that championship. It was his first name. Duncan won. George Duncan won that one. And so, anyways, so when he gets back, in 1920, the U.S. Open... he talks about in his book, he calls it the British Invasion Part 2. That's out of his own words.
Yeah.
He calls it the British Invasion Part 2. And it's because this was the first, you know, the British Open previous year was the first British Open since the beginning of World War I.
Yeah.
Well, now these British golfers, this was their first chance to cross over to America since before World War I. So this is finally a chance for these British golfers to come, you know, and this is because the U.S. hadn't seen any British golfers in years. So it was kind of a big deal. So these British, you know, these British golfers come over to, you know, to play in the 1920 U.S. Open, and the Ted Ray, a name we're already familiar with, wins first. He wins the U.S. Open. And then Harry Vardon ties for second with three American golfers.
Familiar names,
exactly. These Brits, so it's the British Invasion Part 2. They come over and the Brits take the U.S. Open. And so what's interesting about this is that the fact that these, you know, these Americans had gone to the, you know, for years these Americans were sort of in a bubble. You know, like we were talking about how they had like their own style of American thing where they were spinning the ball, they're putting like the rotation on it, you know, the ball to come backwards. And there was like an American flair that they're bringing, like the way they were dressing. You know, they were impacting golf over in Britain. So, but they were playing, you know, they were, and so their first incursion over into Britain, all of them got beat.
Yeah.
They all got beat. And then the Brits come over to the States, and they won the U.S. Open.
Hey.
And so all of a sudden they're like, in Hagen's own words, he said this stimulated us U.S. golfers to go back to the British Open in 1921. So like now it's like a big this is a big deal. They're like that now we're playing. They're starting to play for like national pride. We didn't just win. He's like, we're good. And, even the last basically, series of major tournaments, the Brits have been winning. But what it's starting to really cultivate is this dynamic, this rivalry with these British golfers between American and British, which is going to be one of these things that leads to this Ryder Cup, which is going to be such a significant thing. You see what I'm saying? These rivalries are developing where they're like, we are as good as the Brits and we're going to come, we're going to show it. So the 1921 British Open, the following year, the Americans go back in a pretty large contingent, and Jock Hutchinson, another name we've been familiar with, he was like the sort of favored guy at the greatest game ever played. He's the first U.S. golfer to win the Open, the British Open. He actually wins the British Open. So,
all right.
So it's a big deal. So it's at St. Andrews. America.
Yeah, some freedom fries, and we're gonna go win the Open.
So he did. So the U.S. So Hagen finishes sixth, which of course is a huge upgrade from the 53rd. So it's at St. Andrews. And the St. Andrews, for those that's not familiar, there's a couple of nicknames for St. Andrews, which I've seen in person. It's an absolutely amazing golf. It's just an amazing place. Like, the whole city is basically the golf course. It's like the coolest thing. But St. Andrews Golf Course, it's called the oldest golf – it's sort of the nickname for it is the oldest golf course in the world and also the home of golf. Those are the nicknames for it. It's the home of golf. I've heard that. So anyways, the reason why it's important is because, like, I've got our first quote for today, it's fascinating. I thought it's fascinating because Hagen was there at the 1920 British Open, Hagen learns why a golf course has 18 holes.
Oh.
Okay. So I looked it up. There's one story that's like the most common story about why there was, right, is that there's 18 shots in a bottle of Scotch whiskey. That's what the traditional story is. Okay.
Okay.
And then there's another, like, I saw this other thing by golfing.com or something. It was golf. And they were like, no, that's, everybody says that it's because there's 18 shots in a bottle of Scotch. They're like, but we know the real reason. And it's like because the guy who built that course wanted to have more holes than the one he built, like, at the other course. And it's like, I don't know. You're like reading it going, yeah, but what's the reason? He made more holes, and then, yes, St. Andrews became, like, the place for the Open, and they're like, well, because that was the place where it started, and it had 18 holes, that's what made it so popular. And it's like, yeah, but why 18?
Yeah.
Why not an even, like, a round number, like 20? Why not 10? Why not 15? Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. The St. Andrews is what made 18 holes the main, spread around the world. I believe that to be true. But what made them decide on 18? And I think that goes back to that's why that traditional reason sort of makes sense. But Hagen himself has another reason, which is not all that dissimilar from this year.
I like the 18 shots. I do too. And a bottle of Scotch.
I do too. But tell me if you like this one better. This is straight out of the Hagen himself.
All right.
So Hagen says, I did learn something at St. Andrews, however. I found out why a golf course has 18 holes. I was told of an old fellow, one of the charter members of the club board, who liked to sneak a couple of snorts at each tee to help his game along. The size of his flask permitted him a generous nip for 18 tees, thus limiting the range of his play. He could have been a pal of mine had he lived that long. So he's saying that the one of these charter members, I mean, it's similar, 18, shots out of a jug of whiskey. But think about it. Let's compare the two stories and let's just use logic to see which one of them makes more sense. First of all, Hagen, that's the analogy we heard. This is like one of those folklorish type tales that have been passed down through the generations. I don't. I mean, maybe there isn't somebody with an origin of saying that.
Mm-hmm.
But who is the first one that said, "I talked to this person in 1922 on St. Andrews, and I'm one of the top stars in the world talking to every know-it-all person"? Like, where's the source for the 18 shots out of a bottle of scotch?
Yeah.
Versus that there's an old guy there that was one of the charter members of the club, and then and he's saying, "Hey, you like to have, you know, it's just enough to get 18 drinks out of his whiskey." But so let's compare it for a second too. Let's take it further. Let's take this comparison further, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're walking around on a golf course, you're bringing a bottle of whiskey with you.
Yeah.
And you're going to do a shot, like you're going to do a measured shot at each hole.
Right.
Or is it more likely that you got a flask,
yes,
and you're taking a pull off of it,
sure,
bottling it back up and going back to hit a ball? Which, if you've ever been golfing,
oh, yeah.
I don't know if we can set up a poll for those at home, but anybody that wants to comment in and say which is more likely, that a person had 18 shots walking around with, whether a glass or whatever type of a bottle, and would pour themselves a measured shot, and there was exactly 18 in it, or that there was a club board member who, back in, like, whatever it was, 1863 or 1870, who had a flask, who knew that, he, after a couple times going around, that, was like, "We can't have a 19th hole because my can's gone every time." And one of these guys was a major player at this club back in the day. And don't think of it now. Don't think of St. Andrews the way it is now.
Right.
You're talking about back then. They were still developing the area to even play.
Oh yeah.
And so he's like, "Screw that 19th hole. We don't need it anyways. Let's just go with the 18 because it's just enough for me to get around the course." You know what I mean? Like, which one is more likely? And I think, to me, the Hagen story is more likely.
Sounds pretty reasonable.
It sounds more logistically, rational as well. And so that's what I'm saying. I think this is, so once again, here we are on the show, breaking
100-year-old news.
100-year-old folklorist news, and saying, how many times now have we, broken out, like, we've looked at a mythology of something that has no definitive, origin point. And again, I haven't spent all that much time, or very much time even, looking to see if there is an origin story of the 18 shots in a bottle of scotch. I don't know, I don't know where the genesis of that is.
Mm-hmm.
But what I will say is that I know where the genesis of this story is.
Yes.
And it's Walter Hagen in his own book saying, I did learn something. I found out why a golf course has 18 holes. This is a definitive statement. He's not joking. He's not doing a sarcastic thing going, "Oh, I bet it did." No, he's telling you, I found out something interesting while I was there, and I'm telling you this is what happened.
Right.
So, he's not even that far from the events. I think it was 1872 was the first open at the St. Andrews. He's talking about a story he heard in 1921. That's 50 years removed from the first British Open at St. Andrews, which is not even to say that was, who's to say it didn't, wasn't a year or two after that. So, there is possible that somebody that was there he was told by an old fellow.
Mm-hmm.
So by definition, the old fellow, and if he's in his 60s and 70s, 80s, he would have known the guy who, that the charter member of the club board who did this.
Yeah.
Right. And so he's talking to a potential eyewitness event. So that's what I'm saying. This is, until it can be contradicted by a more direct source than the folklore of just a bottle of whiskey and a bottle of scotch, being the reason, I'm going with this.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the last word I have to say on it. But what about you? Are you,
I think you're on board? I'm on board. Because that other one, there's only like 16 shots in a bottle.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying.
In a fifth, there's 15 measured shots.
Is there?
In a fifth.
Is that,
15 to 17. So it doesn't even hit 18. It's got to be some weak pours there out on the course.
And that's the thing is
to make it to 18.
Is who's stopping? I've played golf a bunch of times in my life, and I've drank liquor and beer on the courses, but I've never stopped to measure out a shot. You're drinking off of a bottle, if anything.
Yeah.
And you're not gonna, so anyways, I like that version of the story. And so once again, City of Champions, we're bringing out stories that you have never heard of.
Breaking ground.
So we're
making them up a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I'm not making anything up. Hagen's telling it. Hagen, this is out of the Hague himself.
Yes.
So anyways, but we're getting right down to it. We're getting, talking about some real history here. So anyways, So anyway, so that's 1920. So Jock Hutchinson wins. He's the first U.S. winner. So anyways, we've talked about, you know, Hagen's like competitiveness. We've brought out some quotes. Hagen's like, you know, thrives on competition, wants to win and all this. And so Hagen is not going to take this loss well.
No.
And he's not. This has now become, like, I was thinking about the title, you know, the episode title for this today.
Yeah.
And I was trying to figure out a clever way to say, like, you know, like, he is Captain Ahab going after the white whale. You know what I mean? But I couldn't. I was like, I was going to have the title, like, the white whale or something. But it just doesn't really go with it. So that's why I put the third time's the charm, because it's going to be Hagen's third. You know, I guess spoiler, but it's the idea is that he was like, I'm not, I got blown out in my first one. My second one, I made the leaderboard, but he's not happy with that. So I've got a great quote here. I'd be happy with 53rd. Are you kidding me? I'd be happy to be out there, man. I mean, so I've got this great quote for him, in his own words, how unhappy he was.
Oh.
And also his rationale for why and what he was prepared to do about it. Okay. So I just thought this is a great, half of this in my book too, but this is a chance to read the full thing. So for the second time, the British Lynx had defeated me. Here in America, we have developed the finest of man-made courses in the world, but the real test of a golfer is a seaside links in the British Isles. Situated close beside the ocean, beset with rolling sand dunes and winds that whip off the channel in the seas, conditions change with the tide. The hazards are far greater than meet the eye. At Deal, I had played shots where the wind picked the ball up and almost slapped it back in my face. At St. Andrews, I learned that distance was secondary to placing the ball accurately. I learned also that in order to be at the top of in the golf profession, I must be able to play any course in the world in par. During the year between Deal and St. Andrews, I had tried to gain skill for the British and Scottish Lynx by playing some of our own seaside courses, such as the National on Long Island, Pebble Beach, and Cypress Point in California. But there was all the difference in the world between these courses and the rugged, windswept Lynx of Sandwich, Hoy Lake, Carnoustie, Prestwick, Troon, and Lytham St. Anne's. I knew the fault lay not with the Lynx, but with my game. With the opportunity to play continuously over them, Harry Vardon, J.H. Taylor, James Braid, and Alex Hurd became masters of the skill required to conquer them. Instead of trying for distance, they worked on a low ball, which would travel hard and sharp against the wind, a ball which they could control. They were experts with the pitch and run shot. They needed to be, for the wind would grab a ball and carry it in any direction. In the United States, we developed the wedge, and it's a fine club where the turf conditions are excellent and the wind is light. We could hit the ball up with action on it, but that same shot on the British seaside links was disastrous. I know because I tried it once the ball was up in a strong wind but the same shot on the British seaside links was disastrous. I know because I tried it. And once the ball was up in a strong wind, the action disappeared, and the ball, minus control, would land on a high green and roll into a trap. After 1921, I worked on a ball hit quail high, a ball hit hard enough to resist the pull of that fierce wind and yet not too fast to roll over a lightning-fast green. I tried for a short approach shots, keeping contact between me and the ball, giving it enough action to cover the uneven approach surface, but not enough to let the wind get under it. I've repeatedly insisted that I liked competition. Well, I had it from the links in the British Isles, and far from upsetting me, it challenged my skill as a championship golfer so greatly that I was more and more determined to win that British Open Cup. So you can see, the ball was getting up in the wind and they're putting these backspins on and all this crazy stuff.
Yeah,
and he's like, I couldn't do that.
Hit line drive. Oh, here, you take this wedge, you pop it way the heck up, and it just bloop, drops right where you want.
He's like, I got to hit line drives out there. He goes, I got to hit line drives. I can't be screwing around with this thing.
I mean, you know, Pebble Beach is a challenge and everything, but nothing till you get on the island,
the
man.
Links, the way he describes it, I love it. He's like,
forget
the windswept cliffs. You know, when he talks about, situated close besides the ocean, beset with rolling sand dunes and winds that whip off the channel in the seas, conditions change with the tide. He said, Anyways, he talks about it. He's like, he just talks about like the cliffs and the wind and the crazy. So anyways, I just love it. He's just saying like, yeah, I had to change it up to doing line drives. I couldn't hit these like foo-foo, like, you know, pop fly type things. He's like, I hit the one ball and it almost hit me in the face. He came back. And he said in the last one of the quotes read last week where he said last show, he said that he had to have – he wasn't joking because he said I needed a catcher's mask because the balls were flying back, almost hit him in the face. So anyway, so that's him getting ready for this tournament. That's why he's like, I'm going to go practice and this. And so, but one of the things that he also needs is Hagen's talked about this before. He's making a ton of money, but he's blowing his dough.
Cars and girls and
everything.
Jets.
Yeah, he's blowing his dough constantly.
Yeah.
So he's doing really well making money, but he's just blowing it. So he doesn't have enough money to get to the 1922 British Open. So he's getting ready for it, but he doesn't have the money, right? And so he talks about it.
I'm going to jump on a slow boat and make it over there.
I just didn't have it. So he's got to figure out a way to make some quick money, okay? And so he's got these friends who are stockbrokers in like on Wall Street, right? This is back in the day where he'd like pay for a seat on the New York Stock Exchange.
Is this where he became the man whore? Is this the
guy? Yeah, you can throw that picture up there. So he's going to come into play here in a second. But anyways, so he's got a couple of friends that are like, hey, you know what you need to do, Walter, is get involved with stocks. He's like, you don't necessarily need to trade stocks, you know, because he's like, what you do is that your name is so big that people are going to want to put their money with you. You're basically going to become like a broker, you know, like you're going to give, you know, people are going to give you their money and then you're just going to put it in like, you know, just target the biggest, baddest stocks out there. And, you know, you're just basically the fact that you can afford to get a seat on the stock exchange is going to give you is going to allow people to like a lot of people are just going to come over and give you the money and say, hey, I want, you know, 20 shares of this stock or 50 shares of that. And you're going to make money from collecting all the it'll cost you like $5 for me to put this trade down for you. You know, like that's kind of how it worked.
What year was this?
So this is 1922. Go 21 going into 22.
All right.
So the stock market's in full swing. This is a roaring 20s.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is the era Walter Hagen's coming up. He's the roaring 20s. You know, he's one of these iconic stars of the 20s. You know, like Babe Ruth is coming out. Babe Ruth is just starting to really come out here. And so, you know, Jack Dempsey and, you know, Bobby Jones and these guys. So anyways, Hagen doesn't get a seat on the stock exchange because for whatever reason, like one day he went and checked it out and it was like 10 grand. And then he was like going to go and then he was like, he like couldn't afford it because he didn't have any money. He was like, he wasn't broke, but he just didn't have like much money. Right. So he had, you know, he could pull together some cash if he needed to, but he just didn't. You know, so anyways, so he had people that were like going to loan him money and then he was going to like, you know, there's friends of his that wanted to kind of help him out, you know, because they could like go, hey, you know, they could hang out at Walter Hagen at a party and stuff. You know, they wanted to help him out. His fame was like enough credit for these people. And so anyways, so like they were going to get him a seat on the exchange, but then it was like the price, like for whatever reason, jumped up from like 20,000, like 10 to 20,000. And then like a week later, it was like 100,000 for a seat on the exchange. He was like, I can't afford all this, right? And so anyways, but what he did instead was, so he, in the meantime, like as the price of that seat on the exchange was going up, the first thing he does is he goes and rents this like office space on Wall Street itself, right?
Okay.
He rents this space. He's got a cashier's window. He's got like a secretary, and he's got this office where he like. And it, so he basically spent the entire time just decorating the office, and like has like everything set. He's like, he's like decorating this out. He's like, I found the greatest painter ever to like write my name on the door, so it was like, you know, Hagen's, you know, like whatever. So he was like, he's talking about all the stuff, all the decor. He's like, I got these oriental rugs and I've got the silk edges for the trimmings for the tables and stuff. And so one of the guys that had suggested to him to do all this comes, he's like talking to me, he's like, hey, did you get the seat on the exchange yet? And Hagen's like, because at first he's like, it's only 10 grand. You know, he was the one that he's like, you need to get that seat. It's only 10 grand. And then like every time Hagen goes back to check, the price is going up. And he's like, I'm just going to wait. It's going to come back down. And so it was. But the guy's like, well, what have you been doing? And he's like, I've been sitting in my office, you know? And the guy's like, I don't know if this is gonna be the right thing for you, man. Like, I don't think this is gonna be the right thing for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's like, you know, you kind of missed your chance, like, because stocks were getting huge. This roaring 20s are just starting to kick in. Stocks are starting to blow up.
Yeah.
And so, anyways, so he basically like spent all of his time like getting his office together and decorating his office, and he wasn't doing any. He's not really cut out for that. You know, he's not meant to be like a stockbroker and take pennies on the dollar. He's meant to be out golfing and taking in suitcases off of a tournament or something.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So he basically kind of fails at his first. He just, all the guys that kind of, that got him into it were like, they just kind of abandoned him. They're like, you're just not, this isn't for you. So they're trying to like kind of push him out. They're going, dude, go back to just like, you know,
maybe golf.
Do some exhibitions, something, but this really isn't, they didn't think it was for him or whatever. Right. But in steps this other guy, this is where you have this sort of like graphic of him, and his name is Jesse Livermore.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is, I'll be honest with you. I had never heard of this guy, and I am huge in the stock market. I love the stock market.
I was going to say, was he cross-pollinated from another story we were telling? But no, all right.
No, he's not. He is. So, I watch every movie that has to do with stock market. I trade the stock market pretty much every day. Yeah. Crypto, all this different stuff. And I had never heard of Jesse Livermore, and this is one of my favorite. Even, and I've read this book a couple times too, and I've never, and I don't remember. But back when I read this, you know, 8 years ago, I had no really interest in the stock market, so I probably zipped right through this section.
Mm-hmm.
But and so in today's world, I'm a little bit more interested, and it was kind of like it's one of these rabbit holes you go down, and you start to like look the guy up, and you're reading about him and all this.
Mm-hmm.
But his name is Jesse Livermore, and there's a couple famous stock brokers of today, you know, stock traders and famous investors today, like Warren Buffett. You've got Michael Burry from the movie The Big Short. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. It's called The Big Short. He's the guy. Yeah. He's the guy that shorted the 2008 2009 crash.
Okay,
right.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And so you know he shorted that. So he's famous for that, right? Well, this guy is like the best. He's one of the most legendary traders, stock market brokers, whatever you want to call him. He is the legend before all other legends. He's like the grandfather of legendary stock market, you know, traders, investors, like I say, whatever you want to call them. This guy is the legend before legend. So that you're probably familiar with the movie The Wolf of Wall Street.
Yes.
So at least the name of it. This guy, they called this guy the Wolf of Wall Street long before anybody else was making movies and about these, you know, the modern day Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, yeah.
But they called him the pioneer of day trading.
Okay.
Like, people didn't like really day trade before this guy. And he also went by another nickname, which is called the Great Bear of Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And a bear in the stock market world means, you know, that you're, that it's, that the market, you know, you're bearish means you think that the market's going to go down, or that you're playing the bear market, which means you're always like shorting the market. You're betting that it's going to go down.
Right.
Well, one of his, amongst his many numerous things that this guy,
I'm gonna call you the bear.
Well, I go up or down. I make money. You know what I mean? Like, I'll take market either way. But in this case, so like the reason why they call him the Great Bear of Wall Street, and this is just amazing, I had no idea, but this guy shorted the 1929 stock market crash.
Oh God,
he shorted that. This guy made $100 million. You know, you always hear about the stock market crash that kicked off the Great
Everybody
Depression.
Lost money.
He won.
That's where it went.
He made $100 million.
That's where it went.
He made $100 million in the 1929 stock market crash. He made $100 million in the 1929 stock market crash. This guy was a legend, okay? But the thing is, if you read his story, he died penniless. He died broke, dude. He was like a cautionary tale about for day traders, because he became a multimillionaire like six different times. And he lost his money like six different times. Like, he declared bankruptcy, I think it was three times. And three other times he didn't declare, but he was basically broke, including at his death. But he, like, one time he lost it all, and he, like, all the jewelry he gave, he had, like, I think it was three wives. And it was his first wife that, like, he lost all of his money. He's like, hey, I need your jewelry so I can get back in the game. And she wouldn't do it. So she was like, no, man, you gave me these. And he was like, our relationship will never be the same. They ended up getting divorced. Like, it ruined their relationship because he was trying to. He was like, "Let me get that jewelry back that I gave to you."
It's like $1.6 billion.
Yeah, Because he made so much money, he was literally blamed for the 1929 stock market crash. They said he caused it because of his shorts. So they blamed him. He had to use that money to hire a small army of security to protect him because people back then wanted to murder him for that.
I kind of want to murder him for that.
Yeah, he shorted the 1929. Yes. I can't even believe it. That's the most legendary.
You kind of poked the pooch, and the pooch was the United States.
Yeah, it wasn't his fault that the market crashed. He just saw the crash coming, and you can bet that the market's going to go down. You can wager that the market, a lot of people wager that the market's going to go up. You buy the stock. If it goes up, you make money. There's a way to do it. There's a mechanism that you can do. In essence, what you do is you basically borrow like $20 million in shares. You borrow the shares, right? Borrow them. And then you immediately sell them into the open market for whatever they're going for at that moment. And then what you're doing then is that if the shares go down, because you borrowed them, it means you have to pay them back. You have to, at some point, buy them back. So if the market goes up, you're screwed because you have to buy them back for more than you sold them for in order to give them back to the people you borrowed them from. So you have to return. What you're betting is that the stocks are going to go down. So when the time comes to return those shares to the person, you can buy them for pennies of what you sold them for up here. That's why it's called shorting the market. So you're betting that the stock's going to go down, and then you're going to repay your loans.
So he did cause it.
Well, he borrowed the money.
He didn't help.
He didn't. Well, yeah. Shorts can hit knock prices down, but
he didn't.
But anyways,
he was not a positive influence.
He didn't help. That's a good point. He was not
helpy Helperton as far as I went. All right.
Especially when you're talking like $100 million. Yeah, that's a lot of money to borrow a bunch of shares and then dump them all at
the same
time.
That's like $1.6 billion now. That's like.
So maybe this is another first that we're bringing on the show is like the cause of the stock market crash in 1929. Jeez. Like all these analysts have been like studying it for all these years, but I've listened to at least a hundred stories. I've watched documentaries on the 1929 crash and all this, and I've never heard of this guy's name.
The Speculator King.
Yeah, this is the Great Bear. He's like he shorts the market and makes $100 million off shorting the 1929 stock market
cheeky
crash.
Monkey you yeah. cheeky monkey.
So imagine this guy walking on there like everybody's like, man, I just lost everything. He's like, well, I had a good day.
I'm lighting cigars with $100 day. bills. Yeah. I don't know.
So anyway, so Hagen, so this, you know,
thanks for the free parking.
Yeah, so the 29 crash, of course, is years in the future. This is 22. And so Hagen's talking about this guy, and he goes, I had another friend named Jesse Livermore, right? And he's like, Jesse was telling me, like, hey, man, I can help you finance your trip.
Ah.
All you got, he's like, screw going to get an office and all this stuff. He goes, you're going to come into my office, and I'm going to front you like 20, like 10 grand or whatever it was. I'm going to let you borrow 10 grand. And he's like, this is what you're going to do. You're going to buy when I tell you to buy. You're going to sell when I tell you to sell. And at the end of every day, you're not going to have any shares left. Every day, that's the golden rule. You're not taking any shares from today to tomorrow. It's every day. Because he's a trader. He's a day trader.
Sure,
that's what this guy's doing.
Yeah.
And so, but back then, so now we got our phone. Robinhood, you know, Fidelity or whatever.
Squirrel.
On our phone. Back then, what'd you say?
Squirrel? I don't know. There's probably one squirrel.
No, there's not.
There is.
It's a squirrel.
I'm working on it, yeah.
Okay, if you're
it's
working on it.
It's the one I'm working on.
So I'm not crapping on your dreams. There will be a squirrel. You're trying to think positive. I get it.
I am. All right, but you know, there's all kinds of apps you can just do it.
Yes, but back then it was different. Like you actually had to like have, you had to have somebody on the exchange. You had to have, you know, phones. This guy, so Jesse Livermore, Hagen describes this guy's office. He's like, he let me in. He's like, basically he had all these gatekeepers, like all these like women on the phones and all this, secretaries all over the place. He was like, it was a series of rooms and gates until you get to like the inner sanctum, which is where Jesse's office was. And it's awesome. He goes into detail about what this guy's office looks like. And he's like, he spent 10 days. And he's like, he goes, I know for a fact that this guy, he's like, very rarely did anybody get as far as this inner sanctum.
Right.
He's like, very rarely. He's like, this guy, he didn't like anybody, you know, being in that certain room. But he said, like, during the market hours, which were only up until 3 o'clock, according to Hagen back then, he said Jesse Livermore was on the phone. Like, he has like four different phones in his hand. The phone's just nonstop ringing. He's telling everybody what to do. And he paints this picture, this like, you know, this of an extremely successful stock trader, of how stock trading worked back before the computer, back before the internet, back when you had to have a guy sitting in a chair on the exchange, making your, you phone it in and they make a move for you. So it's just kind of
picking up some frozen concentrated orange juice.
Yeah, like the training place. Yeah. It's one of the greatest endings of any movie ever.
$1.
Yeah, and then you know the follow up of that too, when after they broke the what were the two, what was the two guys' names?
Yeah.
The two guys, older guys.
Randolph.
Yeah, Randolph and Mortimer.
Randy, like Randy Jackson.
Yeah, Randolph and Mortimer. So they, you know, they broke them in Trading Places, Coming to America, Eddie Murphy's character hands off the bag of money to them, and he goes, "Randolph, we're back in business.
It's one of
the greatest scenes that sort of goes under the radar. But anyways, so Jesse Livermore tells him, "Just do as I do." And he does.
Yeah.
And Hagen makes enough money in 10 days. In 10 days to finance this entire trip.
How about work 20 and then retire?
Yeah, there you go. But Hagen's, you know, he's probably too rambunctious for that. He's got 10 days was a lot for him to be sitting in an office making, you know, doing trades and stuff, right? Buying and selling stocks. But, you know, he has this whole section about his Wall Street experience and how it really culminated with this. And he also, we'll get into a second, but he spends a ton of time talking about Jesse Livermore, and we're going to get to that in a second, but just he's so massively grateful to him for how he helped him. So we'll talk about that in a second. But anyways, after he sort of gets the money he needs, now he goes back out like on like out to play tournaments and get ready for the Open. And he talks about a book. He said 1921 was like one of my best years he ever shot, right? And so right off the bat, he wins the PGA Championship in 1921. He wins the Michigan Open. He wins the West Coast of Florida Open. Jeez. And in the West Coast of Florida Open, he shot a 62 on one of the rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And that 62 was the all-time record for the lowest score in any like major competition.
Wow,
in any legit competition, because this is the West Coast of Florida Open. This wasn't, you know, this is the all-time record for the lowest score, which stood until 1951, 24 years. That was the lowest score. So he hits this, and then he wins the Western Open. So he just wins all these Opens. And then I've got a great quote here about sort of like where he's at right after he, you know, he's coming back from this, or he's going to the Western Open. So he says, I won the Western Open at Cleveland in 1921 too, and I hadn't even intended to enter. I was in New York heading back to Detroit when I picked up a newspaper before getting on the train. The first words I read, of course, were on the sports page. Imagine my chagrin when right at the top of the page I saw a small boxed item with my name in it and the reporter stating to the world that I was through as a golfer. Hagen all through, I read again. Where in hell is the next tournament? I said to anybody who happened to be near. I'll show that fellow. In another column was the announcement of the Western Open at Cleveland. I changed trains at Buffalo early the next morning and headed south.
Oh, man.
I hadn't planned to enter the Western Open, so that reporter did me a big favor. When the final scores were posted, I was right there at the top, the winner by 5 strokes over Jock Hutchinson and Bobby Jones. As I clipped the results listed in the New York in the Cleveland Plain Dealer to mail to my doubting friend in New York, I was still muttering to myself, Hagen all through? The boy's just starting. And fired up like that, I went on to win 4 other major championships that year. I was playing sharp golf, and when I crossed the Atlantic for the British Open in 1922, I honestly believe my year for winning that prize cup had finally arrived.
Uh-oh.
So he's just crushing tournaments, and he's like, this guy goes, Hagen's all through, like, you know, like, are you not paying? Talk about a terrible, terrible prediction. I mean, that did not come true. And it was funny. It was like, I was clipping out the article. While I was clipping out the article, ready to mail it to the guy, he goes, all of a sudden, I was thinking to myself, you know, like he's not saying he stopped. He's saying, as I clipped the results listed in the Cleveland Plain Dealer to mail to my doubting friend in New York, I was still muttering to myself, Hagen all through, the boy's just starting. So he's not saying, you know, like, oh, I was cutting it out. I was going to cut it out, and then I got distracted. He's like, in a matter of course, one of the things I did was cut this out and mail it to this guy.
Yeah.
You know, so he's Hagen's just so great. Hagen's so freaking great, man. We're big fans of Hagen on this show. If you can't really tell,
I am. I'm loving
it. So he's like, while I was cutting this out to mail to this guy.
Yeah.
So, anyways, So now we're at the 1922 British Open, played at the Royal St. George's Links in Sandwich. So anyways, we're not going to go. There's he doesn't really, you know, talk. He doesn't really dive too much into it. He talks about he basically was running away with the tournament. I mean, we've already kind of given away. This is the third time he's come in. We kind of spoiler alerted the fact. He wins this tournament. So, but he it was a bit of a nail biter only because he thought he was in a crush. Like he was like just playing so well. And then George Duncan, the guy who had won the Open two years prior, he just has this incredible, massive comeback at the very end. And so he runs it all the way down to where he's basically, he's only one stroke behind Hagen, and he's got to sink this one putt to tie and set up like the tiebreaker, extra round. But his putt's like but Hagen reminisces about the fact that this one particular hole, he had done the same. He had been in the same situation as Duncan, and it had cost him a stroke. Mm. And he was sitting there going, I hope he does the same thing I did, and he did. And it ended up costing him a stroke, and that's what gave him the ultimate title.
Right.
And so he won by a stroke at the 1922 British Open. He wins his first Open, and now it's like he's won everything. I mean, we got a picture of him here. This is
on the course there. Yeah.
Yep. This is
St. George.
This is on. Yep. This is 1922. This is him at the British Open.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And then with the trophy.
Yep. And then we got a picture of him with the trophy. Those are the three guys. I can't even see from here. We got Jim Barnes. These are all of his buddies. Yep. You're going to see these guys, Jack Hutchinson.
Joe Kirkwood and Jack Hutchinson and Jim Barnes.
Yeah. And Joe Kirkwood, we're going to be talking about him in our next episode. Joe Kirkwood is awesome. It's going to be his traveling buddy. Oh. And we're gonna have a lot to talk about Joe Kirkwood. So remember that. That's for the next episode.
I can party with Joe. I think looking at
They're all cool, man. You see Hagen. He's got his trophy. He's got his little claret cup. It's the claret bowl or whatever the claret cup they call it.
But was the PGA Championship before or after this?
He won the 1921 PGA Championship. So it was before this because this is
All right.
It was at the graphic end.
Says 22.
Well, you this is the 22. What is it? What does it say?
That's the PGA. It says PGA 22 on it.
Oh, maybe. Hold on a second. Maybe I mislabeled
it. He's there with
that.
Barnes and Gates and Hagen.
Okay. Let me just. I may have mislabeled that. I don't think the 22.
All right. I didn't know what I was trying to pull this one. I was waiting to pull this one up. And
does it have the wrong year? Let me see.
No, sorry. And then, but he definitely did the Open in 22. He's there with the trophy, and those boys doing that. Now we're fact checking.
Yeah,
I'm good. I'm not so worried about facts.
No, here I got
it.
I like
story.
Yeah, I got it right here. It's
just messing with you, man.
No, it is. This is. It says. No, it was 1921. So if you're looking at the graphic, it is. Yeah. I mislabeled it. Yeah.
So that was before he went to the Open.
That was before he went to. So that's the 1921 PGA Championship. Well, yeah. All right. It's, so if you're watching the graphic, I messed up on the year because I had 22 on the brain from the
other. Well, we're talking. We're talking
I'm glad
about
you caught that, Jamie. Thank you for catching that. So, anyways, yeah. So he wins at this late rally by Duncan is avoided. He still wins. But I just think those are some phenomenal pictures.
Oh yeah,
these are at the moment. You don't even see the group photos all came from his book himself. You don't see them on the internet anywhere.
I like the Joe. You said Joe Kirkwood and him travel together. I'm not kidding when I say I want to party with Joe.
Yeah. No, he's that's why Hagen brought him along. Hagen's awesome. He's gonna say it was one of these other guys. I think it was Jim Barnes. It was one of these guys. No, it was Gene Sarazen. Gene Sarazen is going to start to become a bigger name. We're going to be hearing a lot coming up.
Right.
But Gene Sarazen wanted to travel for him because he's going to start doing a lot of exhibitions in the next show. We're going to talk about it because he did these phenomenal exhibitions. And Gene Sarazen wanted to travel with them, but he was like, "No, I'm taking Kirkwood." Because we're going to see why Kirkwood was incredible. He's really cool.
Right.
But anyways, so Hagen now. So I just want to mention here, once again, to mention Hagen's gratitude towards Jesse Livermore for helping him. And he actually, and it's not inconsequential. He doesn't just say, I just want to say that was great that you helped me out. He is he spends three pages talking about how valuable it was of what Jesse Livermore, how much he helped him at this moment. And I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but just to kind of summarize, like, you know, I'm going to read a quote here about it just to give a little brief, sort of, you know, so you can hear in Hagen's own words a little bit. But he's got many pages that lead up to, like, what it's like to be a pro, what it's like to be a pro golfer, how tough the schedule is, how you're constantly, like, you're on the go constantly, you're doing pro tournaments, you're doing, like, he paints a picture of golf at this time of how much of a brutal lifestyle it is, especially like when it comes to the money aspect. And he's like the one thing that used to be the most valuable to me was that was being able to relax and not have to worry about. He's like, when I didn't have to like worry about money and everything, and I was like, and I could just go play golf and relax and take the, you know, like party at night and just kind of live my lifestyle and not have to worry about trying to just make money to get to the next town or whatever. He was like, that's when I played my best. When I could just be myself and do my thing. And so that's what he spends a lot of time.
Very unorthodox.
Yeah. But he's like when I'm relaxed and I'm just like, you know, he doesn't even care about being hungover. He just doesn't want to have to, basically, he doesn't want to have to worry about money. He doesn't want to have to worry. Yeah. He's like, if I'm going from town to town, I don't want to worry about, he's like, I want to be able to live the lifestyle I live. It's just like, if I can't and I'm upset about it and I'm just strained out about it, then it's going to throw my golf off. So anyway, so he talked about, so that kind of leads up to where he kind of picks us up right here talking about Jesse Livermore. So he says, the professional who plays tournament golf must make the courses and clubs where the good prizes are, and that's where the big galleries are, and we're right back to relaxation again. For he can play those tournaments and those exhibitions only if he can handle his game round by round and hole by hole. He has to concentrate on his game and forget to worry about the ticket home. The pro can play in the British Open, can make the trip across the pond every year, only if he can raise the cash. He can travel as I traveled on the finest ships of the Cunard line, live in the best hotels, enjoy the social and recreational activities of England and Europe, and play the relaxed game of golf I was able to play, only if he is as lucky as I was in having the friendship and generous financial direction of a man like Jesse Livermore. Our association continued right up until my last win of the British Open in 1929. In the spring of that year, he telephoned and asked me to visit him at his home in Lake Placid, New York. I found him confined to his bed, but the old familiar four telephones were beside him. He was still active in the market. I spent the afternoons teaching his lovely wife and daughters to play golf and spent the mornings and evenings reliving with Jesse the thrills of my annual 10-day trading splurge on Wall Street. And I am sure to this day that Jesse, this is key, listen to this, and I am very sure to this day that Jesse Livermore's name should be engraved alongside of mine on those four British Open Cups I carried home to the United States. That's how far he's talking about. This guy was so important to him that he says his name should be engraved on the Open Cups that he brought back. That's like,
if it wasn't for him, it wouldn't have happened.
That's how much he valued him. So that's what I'm saying. Like, this guy played a key role. Yeah. He played a key role.
There was probably other types of mentorship going on too, you know.
Could have been. Just, you know, absolutely.
Keeping your head in the game. Just, you know.
Yeah, sure. And that's what I mean. Like, so he's, you know, that's why it's worth mentioning this guy. It's worth talking about him because, you know, he was a signature person. You know, he's like, he talks about him, how he helped him just get out there and, you know, have the money. So having money, I just thought there's another little interesting little tidbit. Because Hagen had the money, he said basically every tournament I ever had, like the money that I was getting from a check, like you would have to use that for like getting home, you know, like for these tournaments because you didn't make that much. Yeah. So check this out. For winning the Open, the British Open in 1922, for winning it, check out how much money he made.
How much
do you want to guess? Guess.
$4,000.
$375.
Oh, $300.
$300. Because the British still hadn't done the big gallery thing yet. They were still operating the same, like, past the kitty from before World War One.
Oh my God.
They didn't have the big purses yet. That's why they're getting burned on their trips going out there, because they're not making any money while they're out there. So they're making a bunch of money in the U.S. to try to, you know, the seed money to get out to, you know, to go play. But once they're there, all the hoopla and gala stuff, what they're doing out there.
Then why play them?
And the winner of the tournament gets $375. Well, that's what it's saying. That's what kind of goes back to the original thing we were talking about at the beginning, which was like the national pride of going to play in Britain. What it took to get these people out there.
And they won ours. It's like, all right, I'm going to come win yours.
But the thing is, it was the national pride that took him out there, because it sure as hell wasn't the money. He won the tournament and got $375. But Hagen said, so it wasn't just about that he didn't have enough money to just go out there. I mean, it's going to cost him some money to be out there, you know?
That's not, and three. That's not even one of those big Happy Gilmore big checks. They just give them. They just give them a small check. It's just a small check.
They just give them the hat that they passed all that passed around to collect the coins.
The money, yeah.
But what's interesting
half
is because
of it's rolled nickels.
Because Hagen is kind of well off at this point because of this, you know, Jesse Livermore and the stock market. Yeah. Is he gave that check the $375? He did get a check. It says right here he gave that check. $375. He gave it to his caddy.
Oh my!
He's like, here you go, bud. Yeah. You help me win. Here you go.
This, you need this one to get home.
Yeah. Well, he gave him $375 to his caddy, which is like he gave his tournament winnings. Yeah, so I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And this is the final little element I have to talk about here.
All right.
Because Hagen's coming home. Hagen comes home, and this is a phenomenal thing. This is a phenomenal thing. So So he's coming home, right? We got a picture on that ship. We already showed it, but this is like him on the ship coming home. So this is like the exact moment he's like talking about.
I don't know. Was it an older picture?
No, we just had it. It was the second to last picture he showed. Yeah, the tan picture. Yeah, there we go.
Oh, that's on
the them ship. On okay. that Cunard line. Oh, Cunard line coming back to coming back. So he says. I cabled a few of my pals in New York to set up a celebration at the Biltmore Hotel for the night of my arrival back in the United States. Instead, hundreds of cheering golf fans turned out at the pier along with the 7th Regiment Band and New York's official greeter, Grover Whalen, decorated with his famous boutonniere. A fleet of limousines waited to whisk my party off to City Hall for an official welcome from Mayor Hyland and a ticker tape parade. To the best of my knowledge, that fleet of cars with a dozen motorcycle policemen screeching a path on Broadway was the first ever to be accorded to a sports personality.
Ah, so the first sports ticker tape parade.
First sports ticker tape and motorcycle escort and everything. Walter Hagen, 1922 British Open winner.
Wow.
That's another first. That's another, you know. It's, you know, this is before the heyday of the New York Yankees, too.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So New York, that's a lot of people talk about the Yankees and all this, and they look at Babe Ruth Babe Ruth is really starting to emerge at this point.
Sure, sure.
But this is like, you know.
Babe saw that.
The New York Giants.
I want a parade like Walter's.
Well, yeah, probably. Once they started doing it, they saw how cool it was, and it's like they started making it a thing.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing.
So he got the first, you know, he said, you know, to his knowledge, he's like, I got the first ticker tape parade.
I love it.
So, you know, this is where we're at. Hagen's the man, dude.
That's it.
Once again, Hagen's the man.
I can't wait to continue it next week.
Yeah.
So, everybody, like, subscribe, leave a comment, and we appreciate you being there, right? So,
what's the moral
tell
of the story?
Some
what's the summary of the story? Hagen's the man.
Hagen's the man. Hagen's the man.
That's some more. What have we learned from today's episode?
Hagen's the man.
Thank you.
Hagen's
what
man.
Have we learned from
and
today's
generous.
Episode? Yeah.
Can you imagine how much did it cost for the ticker tape parade and the police escort?
Yeah.
And he's like, he only won $375.
Yeah, he won $375. They're like, he's like, man, I got $375.
It's like the police escort probably got paid $500 for the day. You know?
but he comes back and he's like, how much did you get? How much did you get for winning? Then he's like, $375. And they're like, $1,000? And he's like, no, $100. He's like, they're like, oh, that sucks. And Jesse, you know, the Jesse Livermore is asking him, you know, going, how much did you make, Walter? You know, and he goes, $375. He's like, what? He's like, that's what I tipped the guy at the front door. You know, he's like, that's nothing. And he goes, I know, but I got this silver claret cup though.
That's
you know?
It. All right, we're going to do it again next time. Join us. We appreciate you. Like, subscribe, leave a comment. And wearingfunny.com, you get a cool shirt like that.
Yeah, I got one here. I'm about to break out. You got to get one of these. They're cool looking.
All right, we'll see you next time. It's Detroit, the city of champions.